Look at the next great confession, the Westminster Confession of Faith, better known than the Belgian Confession. Here's the statement. God from all eternity did, by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will, freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass. He ordains whatsoever comes to pass. Yet so, as thereby neither is God the author of sin, nor is violence offered to the will of the creatures, nor is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but whether established. You say, huh? That's just a more elaborate example. The same thing. Got that? God, whatever comes to pass, God unchangeably. See that word unchangeably? That's the key word, that's the mind. The unchangeable God in that sense. I'm God, I change not. Which means that. But he's not the author of sin. And the free will, and no violence is offered to the will of the creatures. Now, what they mean by that is you're free to do whatever is within the definitions of your being. That is, a leaf is free to turn green. It's nature to do so.
You're not discussing God's unchangeability just in this nature.
Well, what is the Bible? They say it unchangeable in the Greek sense. Not unchangeable in the biblical sense. As God is unchangeable in the sense that his moral character never changes. He always hates sin, always loves the right, and always cares for man. You see, if God is unchangeable in the Greek sense, you would never pray except to praise God. There can be no providence. Suppose your wife gets sick. Why pray? Would you ask God to heal her? Help her get well? No. Why? Because her fate is already set. God can't change. Our first parents, being seduced by the subtlety and temptation of Satan, sinned and eating the forbidden fruit. This is Genesis 3:6-3, right? This, their sin, God was pleased, according to his wise and holy counsel, to permit, having purposed to order it to his own glory. Now, would you disagree with that statement as it stood alone? Just that statement, standing alone, would you disagree with it? I wouldn't. No, that seems to be what happened. Did God permit it? Yes. Did he work things to his glory? Yes. But you see, that's the permission part of it. As you already said, the efficacious part of it. Whatever comes to pass, God unchangeably ordains.
God was pleased with it. The statement that he says, just their sin, God was pleased.
No, it doesn't say he was pleased with the sins. It was pleased to permit, as he chose to permit. That's the plea. They used to please in the sense that he wouldn't. It was his will to permit it. Not saying he's pleased with it. Of course, the difference would be truly be who's he now. Now, look at the book I'm citing is this book. I'll give you an example. Now, those are the ancient confessions. This is a modern book. You can see it's come from the 16th century. Typical by Palmer, it's a standard Calvinistic. Put out by Baker Bookhouse, it's not some obscure, off the wall thing. It's a standard. He says this: God is back of everything. He decides and causes all things to happen that do happen. He is not sitting on the sidelines wondering and perhaps fearing what is going to happen next. Now that's a caricature. Nobody ever said he was wondering or fearing what was going to happen next. That is not the alternative. You understand that? That's called a prolepsis in argument. Prolepsis, you know what that is? That's where you state the other man's position with a twist to it and then refute it before he gets a chance to state it himself. It's an old debating technique. No, he has ordained everything after the counsel of his will. the moving of a finger, the beating of a heart, the laughter of a girl, the mistake of a typist, even sin. Did that say it last day? Even he caused it. God caused sin. If you're a consistent Calvinist, you have to believe that. And consistent Calvinists do. God directly caused sin.
Doesn't this make God be out to be a big bad bully then? That a lot of people like to pick on us for. You know, people like to say, you know, God's mean and all this. He only chooses those who wants to go to heaven.
You know, God of Calvinism isn't a very attractive God. You get what he's saying here? There's a typist going along, and her little finger reaches, her ring finger reaches for the X, eats whatever's next to it, Z. Why did she do that? Because in the forecast, in the knowledge of foreknowledge of God, in the ages past, God, for his own praise, did something for everything that happened to him for the purpose. He wanted it in her own field. Why? I fulfill his eternal purpose.
You'll take that into account,
aren't you? You'll take into account the grade is for it. Don't be annoyed with him. Now, you see my point. I was not caricaturing their position when I talked about the tree in the woods. Everything happens. Now, it is even biblical to say that God has foreordained sin. I'm reading now. If sin was outside the plan of God, then not a single important affair of life would be ruled by God. For what action of man is perfectly good? All of history would then be outside of God's foreordination. The fall of Adam, the crucifixion of Christ, the conquest of the Roman Empire, the Battle of Hastings, the Reformation, the French Revolution, Waterloo, the American Revolution, the Civil War, the two world wars, presidential assassinations, racial violence, the rise and fall of nations. Then I take it to local abort. What's going on in the local abortuary? I'm going to reject it. Why? What's going on in there? Whatever's going on in there, the will of God. To say on the one hand, now we're down to the fun part, page 85. Say on the one hand that God has made certain all that ever happens, and yet to say that man is responsible for what he does? Nonsense. That's the word I used, you can call it. It must be one or the other, but not both. To say that God foreordains the sin of Judas, yet Judas is to blame? Foolishness. Would you agree that it's foolishness?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Logically, the author of The Predestinated Thief was right. God cannot foreordain the theft and then blame the thief. Logically. And the Calvinist freely admits that his position is illogical, ridiculous, nonsensical, and foolish. This in accord with Paul, who said, the word of the cross is to them that perish foolishness. Which is not exactly what Paul is talking about. The interesting thing is, he says that, this is 1 Corinthians 1, it was to the Greeks foolishness. One of the reasons it was foolishness is because it defied this dualistic mysticism, this mystical epistemology approach. It stood in opposition to it. He says it's the same thing. I didn't mean to say that. You see that? It's the opposite. And Paul, it was mystical dualism against the rational gospel, among other things. Well, so you see, I have not misrepresented them. And you see the deadly error of Calvinism. It all stems from. If you say the Bible if one of you students said in class one day, well, you know, I've been here 2 or 3 years and I've been studying the Bible and I think it's nonsense, I'd kick you out of school. Do we really want to have fellowship with? Do you have ecumenical unity with people who believe that? I'll tell you, I'd be in danger of my, I'd fear for my eternal soul if I accused God of giving you a word revelation that was foolishness, nonsense. Now, we're not saying that the thing is simple. Here's the question. Did God, by the act of creating man as he is, limit the range and impact of his own active determination? Calvin said no. The Bible teaches yes. But God limited himself. God is not willing, Peter says, that any should perish, right? God is not willing that any should perish. Do some perish? Yes. Why? Because God has, by the act of creating people in his image, he has limited the range and impact of his own active determination. Self-limitation. Is God limited? Calvinism cannot tolerate the idea that God is limited in any way, because God is sovereign. If you limit God one iota, he's not sovereign. Is God limited? He most certainly is. How did he get to be limited? He imposed it upon himself. It is a self-limitation. Let me show you the analogy. If you want to practice self-limitation, that's analogous to this, where you restrict your own freedom, where you reduce the number of your own options in life, all you have to do is get married and have kids. Right? I mean, that money you were going to spend for a new Camaro goes for contact lenses, fillings, and tennis shoes. Trust me. You were going to go out to eat, but you don't. Why? You can't find the babysitter. Get sick. You want to talk about limiting yourself? Just get married and have kids. You'll limit yourself. One of the problems we got today is too many people want to get married and act like they're not limited. They want to have kids and not raise them. Now, does anybody force you to get married? Hope not. Unless they had a white bow on the shotgun. Anybody says you're going to have kids whether you want to or not? No. My wife and I had four kids. And we did it by choice. I married the woman I chose to, but boy, I limited myself. Did I ever? I'm fine. But you see, and my children have freedom of the will. When they were little, they did exactly what I said to do, because I had absolute control of my wife and I. You know. But you wait. And you get older. But that's the way it is. Self-limitation. Now listen, God was already limited by his own character. He cannot lie. He's limited by reality already. God can't make 2 and 2 equal 5. You know that, don't you? God is the God of things as they are. You can give him 2 of anything. He can change them 2 of anything else. But you give him 2 more of them, and he's only got 4. Even God cannot defy mathematics, because God is the real God of the real world. So God is limited by reality. Part of that reality is the reality of his own character. Part of it. And God has practiced self-limitation. He is not going to any should perish. But for the sake of having a family, he lets some choose to perish. Self-limitation. Now that is a critical point. Because Calvin and Luther had Augustine's God, they could not permit that, even self-limitation, because God would not be sovereign. He would say, if God wanted the typist to hit the X and she hit the Y, then she is God in the universe. Now, question. Yes.
Every one rational, if God's rational, 2 and 2 equals 4, how many times Jesus take 2 loaves and feed all the people and pick up 1?
He didn't define mathematics, he defined metaphysics. That is, he did an act of creation. But when he got coming to him, and they took up the 12 baskets full, he added 12 more, and they had 24. But he did not divide. He had nothing to do with mathematics. It was an act of creation. You understand this question, my answer? It's a good question. That is, when God created the universe, there was an act of creation. But when he got done, there was only one universe, as far as we know. If you had another, you only have two. When that applies whether you're a universe or bread or fish. Okay. Here are two views that oppose Calvinism, not get sticky. First is this simple permission. If man is to freely love God, the possibility must exist that he will not love God. Therefore, God, by the nature of the creation, gives man permission to reject him. This view does not completely solve the problem of God's holiness. This view is very close to Calvin's efficacious permission. Now, this is the view that I hold. Simple permission. Not, you understand? What is the difference between efficacious permission and permission? Is it a small difference? In a sense, yes, but it is all the difference. But small differences very often are all the difference. That is, see, the Calvinist would, in regard to all that we've said thus far, the Calvinist would respond, now wait a minute. If a man permits something, is it not the same thing as causing it? That is his guilt not the same? Does our law not say that? Civil law? Yes. Maybe not equal guilt, but the same kind of guilt, yes.
Even more so than that, you could ask for, in the sense of your analogy, using man would not be the same, but if you're using God to say that God permits sin to happen, well, he was the one who created the situation which permits the sin to happen.
Free will.
Roundabout
way, he is a cause. Remember, I said it wasn't simple? Is it a small difference? Yes, it's a small difference. That is, did God not create possibility, the situation which it could happen? The answer is yes. Does that create a problem for somebody like myself who holds the view of simple for permission as opposed to efficacious permission? The answer is yes, it does. That is, now listen to me. Does God permit sin? Question. Does God permit sin? If he permits it, then what's the difference, Calvin says, between saying he caused it? We would say for the sake of free will, he permits sin.
Right.
But that doesn't change the fact that he permits sin. Pardon?
We chose what I'm a sinner. There's a world difference between he caused me to sin.
Yes. It's a different thing. But ultimately, is God not culpable? Is God not guilty? Blamable? It's like the analogy of the parent. One of the things I have in my family life class, which I'm teaching next quarter, is the principle of what you permit, you teach. You permit a child, if you've got a kid that throws tantrums, and you look the other way, are you not teaching that child that's acceptable behavior? You'll knock the sun out of them. Does God permit sin? Mr. Caputo, does God permit sin?
I'm trying to think. If he permits us, he gives permission to sin. Mm-hmm. Does
Permission is only the sense that he created a free will. He does not give active.
We have free will to sin. Mm-hmm. We have free will to repent. Does he take, if you were to cause sin, does that then take away the permission we have to repent? I mean, if I was a Calvinist and I said, I have no choice, God caused sin, then that means I have no choice, I can't repent.
That's exactly what Calvinism said. That is, man's repentance is not a cause, it's an effect. He repents because that's the will of God.
Does God permit us to repent? Or does he already forgive us? I mean, is it particularly
forgiven? I haven't followed you here.
Are we permitted to...
Wait a minute, you didn't answer my question. Are you trying to answer my question?
I'm trying to get it straight.
Okay. How many think he does?
He doesn't ultimately.
What?
He doesn't ultimately commit sin.
What did you just say? The answer to the question is no. Not ultimately. God permits sin temporarily.
Is that not because he knows he causes sin temporarily?
No. Wait a minute. Ultimately, God does not permit sin. It's what the doctrine of judgment in hell is all about. Nobody gets away with anything. The only people in the world that get away with anything are Christians. Why doesn't God stop all the evildoers? Why doesn't he punish them?
Wait.
Hang on. Just Tim.
Oh, I was going to say what you just started again. The point of with the analogy of the family and permitting your son or daughter to do something and you don't punish them. I was going to say that God does permit sin because he's going to do it for his children.
But isn't that temporary permission the same as temporary?
Do you know what Daryl's asking?
That's a logical statement.
Exactly right. That is that not? It is not even temporary sin for the time being, for the sake of free will. Is not God in some case, in some sense, guilty? That's the question. Can God be blamed in some sense for sin?
No. You want to take from the perspective that he created me? Am I agreeing with
you? Are you saying yes or no?
I'm not just...
Come on, get up one way. You're the fish or cut bait. Come on.
Just as we have the free will to sin.
Wait, answer my question. Yes or no? Melissa, is God in some sense responsible for human sin, even in temporary sense?
I'm saying yes.
Wait a minute, hold on, this is it. You say yes, what do you say?
Yes.
Very half-hearted. I think so. In some sense. In some sense.
That doesn't violate his character at all? Nothing holy and just?
No.
Just.
It doesn't, because if there were no ultimate punishment of sin, it would. I think. That is, the Bible teaches us very clearly that the integrity, the justice of God is vindicated in the cross and in hell.
What would you do then if God permits it in a limited sense? How do you answer the Calvin that we come back to say that God comes to him, not Satan?
The answer, the difference between efficacious permission and simple permission is a very subtle difference. The difference is this, the difference is between active and passive. The difference is between a God who actively permits sin temporarily, and the God who passively... I'm sorry, I didn't say that right. It's the difference between a God who actively causes sin temporarily, for the time being, and a God who passionately permits it for his own purpose. And the answer is, as far as I can tell, the only answer I have is that God permits it because the value to him of human freedom of the will, which creates the possibility of genuine love, is worth it to him. He has the right to do that. And his righteousness, his justice, is ultimately vindicated by the doctrine of the cross and by the doctrine of judgment.
You said what you commit, you teach. Okay. Now, you just said God commits things.
I said that relates to children.
Temporarily.
Yeah.
So then God commits sin temporarily, but he teaches the effect of it.
Well, I didn't apply that to God. I was given a human level. But God permits. You understand what I'm saying? If we're right about this, see, this is a very subtle difference. But there is a difference. Now, yes.
The last main question you asked
is God in some sense responsible for temporary condition of sin, human sin? And my answer is yes.
Okay, if we say yes to that, then aren't we saying that in some sense God is responsible for people going to hell?
In some sense. If he hadn't created them, they would be there.
But
you see, we don't believe in the Greek concept of God. God is passable. Is he like a parent can be grieved by what his creation does against his will?
Very, very short jump to predestination.
Yes, it is. That's a short jump to efficacious permission.
So if I take to say that God is ultimately responsible for sin.
Ultimately?
In some sense.
In some sense. Only in the sense that he created free will and free will.
Because he created man and he knew that man had the possibility to sin. But the sin was ultimately responsible to man. He knew right from wrong.
Ultimately, right.
So God, what he's ultimately responsible for, is creating the situation. Not really the sin.
Right. That is a difference. That is a difference. A huge difference. The difference is, now listen, let me teach you how to think about this. Do not commit the fallacy of informal logic, which is the fallacy of the beard. What is the fallacy of the beard? Sometimes called the fallacy of the bald head or something like that. Well, what's the fallacy of the beard? You ever had logic yet?
Yeah, I've never beard is
called logic. Well, it's called, goes by different names. It's the fallacy that says small difference is no difference. It's called the fallacy of the beard. Because, question, Mr. Smith, when you grew your beard, I'll call back to the time when you grew the beard you have now. One day you didn't shave, right? You decided not to shave and grow a beard. Did you have a beard the first day? At what point did your whiskers grow to the point that you had a beard?
It's better.
You don't have a beard before you shave? I mean, after you shave, don't you start a beard?
It's not visible.
But is it a beard? Did you have a beard?
Yes. I'm not sure anymore.
Give me another example of a fallacy. You heard the old story about the fellow who decides he's going to he said he goes out and there's a newborn calf. He picks up the calf and carries it around the barnyard. And he says, well, I'll do it. A calf only gains a few ounces a day. If I can pick it up today, I'll pick it up tomorrow. Right? I can carry Isla today, but Isla tomorrow, because what's the difference for 3 ounces? So he picks up the calf tomorrow. And the same calf only gains a couple ounces the next day. If I pick it up today, what's 2 more ounces? Logically, if I can go out and pick up that calf every day, carry it around the barnyard, when it's a full-grown cow, I'll be able to pick it up and carry it around the barnyard. What's the difference? What's the Bible saying there? You see, if that were true, which it isn't true, it would be based on what proposition? That a small difference is no difference. Now, that is, that on a continuum, that you cannot at any point draw the line. That's the fallacy. Like a beard. When do you say he has a beard? The first day he doesn't shave, or the second day? How much difference is there between the third day and the fourth day? Very little. But can you say on the third day he doesn't have a beard, on the fourth day he does? Or if he doesn't have one the fifth day, can you say, you see what the point? That's this logical thing. How this gets carried away, and this gets carried, let me give you an example of how this is applied to modern conditions. I'm talking about this logical principle now. I think of an example. There are all kinds of them out there. Take a second. But you all see the argument? And part of that thinking is that a subtle difference. But the point is that very small differences are often all the difference in the world, are the critical difference. Now, so, let me give you back to an analogy. It is this difference. Here's a man who has a son as a thief. This man could have been like Dickens Fagin, who teaches him to be a thief. Or like some of the gypsy tribes do, where they teach their children how to steal. That man is doubly responsible. Why? He's responsible that he had the child, brought the child in the world, conceived the child, fathered the child. But he's responsible in a positive way because he taught the child to steal. It's not the same thing at all. It's a huge difference between a father who has a child and lays before him precepts of right and sets a good example. The child, nevertheless, is caught stealing, and the father wails the tar out of him. Is there a difference between the two? A huge difference. The only similarity is both of them are responsible in the sense that they fathered the child. They hadn't fathered the child never was stolen, obviously. It did not exist. Now, you see, the issue is whether there would be man or not be man. And you cannot, it's your argument, the best of all possible worlds. You cannot say that it would be better off if we were not born. We don't know that. And God, who does know, chose to have us born. That is, you see, the choice is not between, now listen to me, teach you how to think about this. Calvin says that God created man, he created sin, he caused it, because it fits his will. We don't know what his will is, his reasons, but he had his reasons, he's God, and we're not, so we just accept by faith, as he did say. Now, but you see, the difference is not whether you control the will of a creation or not. The difference is whether you have a creation or not. Let me explain what I mean by that. Could you, Keith, you got Aaron, your little boy you got. Does he have free will? Sure he does. You did? Hope you threw a big one. Can you guarantee that he won't become a thief?
Absolutely not.
Sure you can.
Guarantee it?
Sure you can.
What if I kill him?
No, you can't. How can you guarantee? Can he not guarantee that Aaron won't become a thief? How can he do it?
I can train him not.
No, that wouldn't be a guarantee. Train him not to be. That would help. How do you do it?
Take away his freedom.
Take away his freedom. put him in a cage, and keep him there the rest of his life. A cage he can't get out of. Would that guarantee him?
Yeah.
Or you could take him to a surgeon and have his frontal lobes removed surgically so he becomes a vegetable. Would that guarantee it? Yeah. How many are in favor of that? If he did that, and we know in your case it would have been advisable. Now, if Keith did that, would that be a moral act? No, what would you say to him if he did? If Keith said, well, I got this little baby, my wife and I decided we want another child, we got this little nice little boy here. But I want to guarantee he's not a thief. I'm going to put him in a cage the rest of his life. What would you say to him? Well, you might say, well, if you were going to do that with him, why'd you have him in the first place? You see, the issue is not, fundamental issue is not whether you control him or not. In Calvin, he keeps man in the cage, in a sense. His will is bound. When Luther said bondage of the will, he meant it. God is absolute. That's what this is, the concept of God. Don't you understand? Man is bound. Logically. They say, well, he is. But the issue is not whether there shall be a man with free will or not, whether man is going to have free will or not, whether your child is going to live in the cage or free. The issue is whether there's going to be man at all or not. You understand that? The issue is that there should be a creation. That is, the only way that God could escape the onus, if there is one, of being in some sense responsible, which you say he is, I think you're right. The only way God could escape the onus of being in some sense responsible for sin temporarily is for there to be no creation of man at all. For God to create man and then not give him free will is its own kind of immorality. Or at least, it is not. If it's not immoral, it is meaningless. If man does not have free will, the creation of man is meaningless, just like to have a child and put him in a cage so he won't go bad. It makes the act of having the child meaningless. Would you not agree with that? So you either have the child or you don't have the child. That's the question. God either created man or he didn't. Now, so is God responsible for sin? The answer is not directly, not ultimately. He is responsible only in the sense that he created a creature who could sin. The Greek God could not do that. The God of the Bible can and did and does and did. Therefore, and that is a very subtle difference, but it's all the difference in the world. You understand? It is the difference between the gypsy, which trains his child to steal, and the father who has a child who steals despite all of his teachings to the contrary. It's a huge difference. So, now do not go out of here and say, well, Chambers teaches that God is responsible for sin. I'm not teaching that. What I'm saying is, he is and the freedom to do that. The divine risk, the eternal gamble. Why did he do it? Well, I think the answer is obvious: love. Think about this. This has, I think, should have students a tremendous devotional impact. Is it not possible for us to say that God helped to a situation where he can be called? Listen, the Holy God put his honor at risk and he put himself in a position where he had, if his purposes were going to be accomplished, had to come to earth in the form of a man, be subject to his own creation, and die the death of the cross. Why did he do that? No Greek impassible God would ever do that. Why did the real God do it? He did it because of love, I think. For God so loved us, he created us. I think he redeemed us for the same reason he created us. What does that say to us? It doesn't say anything else. It says that it's very important. It's worth a lot to God that we love Him. We're very important to Him. And again, the analogy of a child, of raising, of having children. Keith, when you and your wife decided to have your those two little boys, I guess you didn't understand that children can grow up to defy their parents and go bad. You didn't understand that. You didn't know about that, did you? Yeah. I've never witnessed in my life. See, I've seen some pretty horrible things. I used to work in the emergency room in a hospital. I've seen people, all kinds of horrible things. I've seen wrecks. I've seen a lot of people die. I've seen a lot of bad stuff. This is the worst thing I've ever seen or heard. In a church camp in Southern Indiana several years ago. And I was a guest speaker. There was a preacher there. He had two sons. And I forget his name. I don't want to remember his name. He had two sons. Neither one of them worshiped. They had grown up. You know what he said? He said, "I wish to God they had never been born." We've got no children. I wish to God they had never. It's the worst thing I've ever heard. You guys know. I can't imagine. I'd rather see my children dead than have to say, "Look at my children and say, I wish that God I'd never had them." That's the worst thing I've ever seen. The worst tragedy. And I saw that. I had three children after I saw that. By choice. Why? Well, we're in the image of God. And so you knew that, just like I did. These kids can grow up to break your heart. But it just worth it. Why? Well, we're in the image of God. So we, in a sense, created something for love. Understand? Love, here's what I'm saying. Love makes the risk worth it. That's why you have kids, right? Love makes it worth the risk. Now, apparently, it was so with God. And the worst thing about that is he already could see the cross. Genesis 3:15, the cross is already prophesied. So he worked with him. He knew if the cross was going to have to happen. He was going to have family. Does that say anything to us about how important we are to God and how important it is for us to have be in a family relationship with him right now? Because he put his honor on the line and let himself over with all kinds of vicacious permission and permission, yes, to all the difference in the world. Does that leave questions unanswered? Let me ask you this, let me end on this note, on this question. Does it leave a lingering, that's redundancy, is there a question mark lingering over this whole matter? When we are forced to admit that in a sense God is responsible for evil, in the sense that he created a world where that evil could happen. That is, he created a world in which exists human free will. Does that leave a question? To me it does. A theological question. It's not illogical, it's just a question. That is, if God is absolutely holy, then how can we say that even in this sense, he is responsible? And I have no answer to that question. I'll leave that with God. It does not defy logic. It goes beyond information. You don't think about this, son. That's the best I can do with this.
Does that explain the text then where, and now I'm finding this represented, where the blind man, where the disciples questioned Jesus about the blind man, and he said that it's the glory of God that he's blind?
Well, let's take that out next time we meet.